marketplace-based adoption system is historically new. It's only lasted 150, 200 years, like at the longest. This is what is the anomaly. Thinking more deeply and more broadly about other ways of caring for people is how it has been done for most of history.
That was Gretchen Cisson talking about her book Relinquished, The Politics of Adoption and the Privilege of American Motherhood. You also heard from Samantha Gonzalez throughout the show talking about her experience as a birth mother. And that does it for today's show. If you liked what you heard and want more information, please visit us online at www.focmedia.org. I'm Salima Hamrani, and thanks for listening to Making Contact.
Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio.
I'm out to sing songs that will prove to you that this is your world, and that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that will make you take pride in yourself.
I'm Lori Sonnenfeld.
And I'm Don Jacobson.
Together we bring you Moving On, Fridays from 12 noon to 1:30.
We feature both traditional and contemporary folk music.
We love to present live in-studio concerts from local and national musicians.
Tune in and you'll hear music that is socially progressive, moving, and heartfelt.
Music heard only on the left-hand edge of the dial and only on KBOO.
Every Friday, noon to 1:30.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
Welcome to Labor Radio on KBOO Portland. I am Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gilliland.
Thank you so much for joining us. We would first just like to give a special thanks and shout out to the Labor Radio Podcast Network for hosting podcasted versions of our show each month. So be sure to check that out at laborradionetwork.org. And before we get started, I want to let you all know that KBOO has been on the air for 55 years, making us one of the oldest community radio stations in the country and one of the longest standing media institutions in Portland. And we've been able to remain a commercial-free, volunteer-powered resource for the community because of support from the amazing people like you. In fact, 80% of the station's funding comes from the generosity of our members. So if you can, please help us continue to serve this wonderful community by donating today. Just go to kboo.fm/give. We here at Labor Radio thank you so much for your support. So for the discussion on this show today, there's really no getting around it. The results of the 2024 election, and particularly the presidential election, were fairly upsetting for the left and are likely to prove a major threat to progressive policies and to labor rights in particular. Donald Trump's second presidential term will undoubtedly remove the last remaining political bulwarks that have kept organized labor viable throughout the past 40 years of declining membership.
And obviously, you know, we don't get in on this show. We don't typically get super deep into like the political ramifications of, you know, people running or winning certain different races. But obviously, we can't get around the fact that this is going to change things. And we've talked a lot about on the show how even without all three branches of government in control, like the Republicans will have in 2025 and going forward, the executive branch in particular sets so many people up and can determine the goals and kind of the outcomes that are desired from the different governmental agencies that are in play. And we're going to touch on that.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, as a great example of what you're talking about, like, we have discussed in this show a lot over the last 4 years, but the Biden administration has appointed fairly, you know, labor-friendly yes. members of the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board. And that board has then, in turn, supported a lot of unionizing drives at places like Starbucks and Amazon.
Yeah.
And, you know, all the explosions of labor activism that we've seen over the last, you know, 4 years has been largely supported by the presidential administration and the appointees of the Biden administration. And so, as you said, like the party that's in power, and specifically the presidential administration, has a lot of sway over how the government approaches
yeah.
labor and workers' rights. And, you know, so on top of that, like over the last, you know, 40 years or so of, you know, the decline of the labor movement, many unions have forged relatively stable accommodations with their large unionized employers. And in exchange for, you know, quote, labor peace and stability, unionized companies have provided modest wage and benefit increases, steady dues incomes, and incremental union growth through corporate expansion. And indeed, until the past few years, as a, you know, in exchange for that, the unions have largely holstered their strike weapon. You know, they haven't had that be a major thing that they've gone out and done. Obviously, we've seen a change in that in the more sort of active moment that we've had over the last 4 years. But up until that point, in exchange for the stability that has come with this detente with the large employers, unions have kept peace, relative peace, and not brought their membership out on strike, even in moments where they maybe could have actually benefited from that activity. And so, like, that's the first big bulwark that has kept unions afloat in the post-Reagan, you know, couple decades that we've been dealing with. And the other one is that labor has built sort of a junior partnership for itself within the Democratic Party. So in exchange for billions of dollars in campaign expenditures and political ground operations, the Democrats have supported a wide range of legislative and regulatory initiatives that kind of buttress many unions' modest organizing and collective bargaining goals. So, you know, as part of that partnership, the Democratic Party has reliably blocked legislation put forward by the right that, you know, really kind of poses an existential threat to unions. Yeah. A major one of those is the right to work legislation that just keeps being pushed. You know, it won state houses, you know, soon after it was brought up by ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. Mm-hmm. And it won a lot of state houses. And then, you know, during the first Trump administration, there was a big push to make it a federal policy. And, you know, we've discussed a lot on the show, but right to work, the concept of that is basically that a worker who gets hired into a unionized workplace does not actually have to pay dues to the union to be represented by that union. So essentially cutting out the legs from under a union that, like, that's the way that a once a union take, you know, was able yeah. to establish in a workplace, they then have to collect dues from the members in order to be able to afford to defend those members. So that legislation is one of the biggest threats to organized labor, and it has been a thing that has been a desired outcome yeah. of the right for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. And obviously, you know, we're not experts in Project 2025 or where it sits kind of in the ethos of you know, President-elect Donald Trump. But from the little that I have read, things like right to work are going to be at the top of the agenda, especially considering the now control all three branches of government. Oh, yeah. So, I mean, to your point, this stuff is right dead center in the sights of the Republicans and will probably not survive.
Yeah. I mean, you know, just from a 30,000-foot view, included within the near 1,000 pages of the Project 2025 manifesto or document or whatever you want to call it, there are, you know, the things that directly address organized labor, you know, they have goals in there of letting corporations union bust in secret. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so they don't have to make public things like captive audience meetings and things like that. They also want to make it illegal for employers to voluntarily recognize unions. They are also interested in letting employers take away unions mid-contract. So yeah. Essentially just nullifying the contract that they've agreed to and just wiping unions out in the middle of that. They're also interested in letting employers retaliate against union organizers.
Yeah.
You know, we discussed that a lot on this show, specifically looking at things that have happened to workers at Starbucks, you know, locations around the country, and how a lot of the workers who successfully organized their Starbucks locations were then fired for other things,
yeah.
You know, quote unquote, other infractions. Same thing happened to someone like Chris Smalls at the Staten Island Amazon facility that was the first to unionize in the country. You know, he was fired for some other minor infraction instead.
Yeah. So, well, yeah. And we've touched on it, right? It's not just the laws that they pass; it's the people that they put in positions of power.
Yeah.
So again, even if they don't change any laws, right? If they fill the NLRB with a bunch of kind of anti-work folks, then they're just not going to press charges, and a lot of this stuff that's happening quietly behind the scenes will just kind of start to get said out loud, right?
Yeah.
And you know, again, we typically don't dive into a lot of these things, but the Democratic Party in this election clearly lost the hearts and minds of the working class.
Yeah.
And it is very painful as someone who cares deeply about these issues to kind of be projecting out and see what the so-called populist kind of right-wing person who cares about workers is going to do in the first couple years of his second term. And all of those things are not going to help labor or the working class.
No.
And so, you know, it's... The talk track has got to change. Yeah. I mean, Elon Musk being basically the third person on his ticket, and we've talked about him very, very much on the show. I mean, he talks all of the time about how he would destroy unions and workers and all of the rights that we've built up over the last 200 plus years if he was able to. And now he might be able to.
Yeah. I mean, like, he is literally a union buster. Like, he has done that actively at the companies that he owns. So to have that man be, as you said, I mean, he's the de facto vice president. I mean, I guess he's like officially the head of government efficiency, whatever sham organization they put together, or, you know, agency they're putting together. But like, you know, he clearly is going to have the ear of the incoming president. And he's a man that we have discussed the actions that he individually and his company have taken to harm his work there, you know, the workforces at his various companies time and time again on this show. So that certainly doesn't bode well for labor's future under the Trump administration.
Yeah.
Just one other thing, you know, just to close out this list here, a final thing that has been, you know, mentioned by the AFL-CIO that is included in the Project 2025 text is that there is a bullet point in there that would let employers create their own sham company unions, which seems crazy, but like, yeah, the Project 2025 agenda would let employers sidestep national labor laws by creating their own phony employee organizations with fake employee commitments committees handpicked by management.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when a company says like, well, we're all family here, and then it's like, you know, they can take that a step farther and say like, well, we're all part of our own union here together.
Yeah.
And of course, who's in charge of that union? It's the boss at the company.
Yeah.
So that seems... not great.
Counterproductive.
Yeah, exactly. And there's, you know, many more things. Unfortunately, we don't really have time to dive into every plank of the Project 2025 agenda, but there are a lot of things that are going to directly impact working people and labor unions specifically. So maybe in a future episode, we can kind of go farther into that. But yeah, that is, it's upsetting. If, you know, if you care about the health of labor unions and sort of labor rights more broadly. And, you know, we were discussing just prior to that topic, but like we were talking about how up until this point, the Democratic Party or, you know, unions have found a sort of shelter and a junior partnership with the Democratic Party. And part of that, you know, so the Democrats, in exchange for their support, Democrats have largely shielded working people and unions from anti-union legislation that comes from the right constantly. And part of the way they do that is by using the Senate filibuster. And so labor and Democrats have maintained a status quo that has preserved the fragile labor management accommodations by, you know, doing things like preventing right to work and other things. And a lot of that comes through filibustering when those things do come to the floor of the Senate. So it's probably not a stretch to say that under a Senate controlled by the GOP and a House controlled by the GOP and a White House controlled by the GOP, that if they were to present something like the National Right to Work Act and Democrats were to, on the Senate, were to filibuster it, I would imagine Republicans would probably just eliminate the filibuster, and then they wouldn't even have any ability to prevent that. So, you know, big structural changes to even out the balance of power between capital and labor have been another thing that Democrats have done to help labor unions and to prevent further decline in membership that we've been seeing really since the Reagan administration. And unfortunately, despite what we have talked about under the Biden administration, putting forward legislation that would not only blocking anti-union legislation, but putting forward things pro-labor and pro-union legislation has not really been at the top of mind for Democrats. Something like the PRO Act is a great example. Yeah. The PRO Act, which is essentially it builds upon the National Labor Relations Act and goes into further entrenching the rights of unions and workers. That act has been something that has been put forward by Congress. It's been voted on by the House, and it just has not been taken up by the Senate. But it's been sitting there, and it's been something that could be passed by Democratic-controlled Senate that would immediately make it much more difficult for a Republican administration to overturn labor rights. But it sat there, and it has not been progressed anywhere. So that's one of those things where, you know, even though there is a junior partnership between labor and the Democratic Party, it has only gone so far at this point. And we're just going to take a quick break here. If you are just tuning in, you're listening to Labor Radio here on listener-supported KBOO Community Radio. We'll get back to our discussion about what the future of the labor movement under a new Trump administration might look like in just a moment. But first, I want to drop a quick reminder to please consider donating to KBOO now and help us remain commercial-free, volunteer-powered resource for this community. You can donate today at kboo.fm/give. or by mailing your donation to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Thank you for supporting Community Powered Radio, and we here at Labor Radio thank you so much for your support. And now we will get back to our discussion here. So the good news, if there is some good news right now, is that the labor movement has been here before in the not-so-distant past. You know, and hopefully there are some lessons that can be learned from the experiences that were had in the 80s. You know, during Ronald Reagan's administration, his administration was brutally anti-labor, and it accelerated the decline of union membership that had begun in the 50s, but really just, you know, hit hyperspeed once Reagan took over. And so there is, you know, a possible roadmap of what to expect from a second Trump term based on what happened in the 1980s. And, you know, Reagan basically launched an all-out assault on unions, first by breaking the air traffic controller strike, which was a huge deal. You know, they were a very powerful union that performed an incredibly important job, and they were rightfully went out on strike because of conditions that they were dealing with and never really expected that they would be just fired wholesale. That they were such an important and hyper-specialized job that they thought their demands had to be met in some regard. But Reagan's really, his first act, this happened in his first year in office, and he essentially just fired all the striking workers and immediately hired scabs. And honestly, that field, like that job, has been reeling ever since. And that's not the only example of that happening. But that all happened right away in his first year in office.
Yeah.
And by doing so, by breaking such a powerful union, it really emboldened capital to attack unions through, you know, a series of devastating assaults on a lot of companies, you know, companies like Greyhound and Caterpillar and Bridgestone, Firestone, you know, International Paper. Just it basically that moment, breaking the dam, it allowed companies to feel comfortable attacking the unions that still remain at their in their workplaces.
Yeah, and it's to me too, it's tough to imagine the railroad dispute that we faced a couple years ago happening under a Trump administration, especially considering, you know, that was obviously a very special use case in which the government has even more control over the ability of conductors to strike, right? Because it's kind of called out as like a key part of our economic kind of viability and sustainability. Yeah. But just trying to imagine that situation occurring, and obviously, you know, Biden didn't help the union get everything that they wanted, but there were a couple key concessions, especially around paid time off and like medical leave, that are just, you know, if a similar situation arises, I can't imagine it going well for labor.
Yeah, you know, honestly, I kind of going back to what you were saying before, I could imagine a situation where that did arise under a Trump administration, and he would have Elon Musk in his ear saying like, well, just fire them all. And I already have, you know, self-driving trains.
Yeah.
And the first train pulls off and just crashes or you know, something like that. But yeah, so it, needless to say, I can't imagine it would go very well under the incoming administration.
Yeah. Just like Reagan, like you're talking
about. Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, like the Reagan administration, the, you know, the attack on labor that was brought about by this breaking of the air traffic controllers union, and then just the flood of anti-union things that came from them, it was really kind of bolstered by a recession that led to high unemployment, which was kind of explicitly engineered by the Federal Reserve in a way to weaken the bargaining power of unions. So in 1981, the Reagan-appointed Fed chairman Paul Volcker instituted a massive interest rate hike in order to curb inflation. Sounds kind of familiar. Mm-hmm. And as a result, unemployment peaked as high as it really did in the 2008 Great Recession as well. And as a result of that, union membership and union support went into freefall. And Volcker kind of explicitly viewed breaking the power of organized labor as a critical piece of his anti-inflation crusade. And, you know, he even went so far as to declare, quote, "The standard of living for the of the average American has to decline," end quote.
It's a crazy thing to say.
Right? To say that, like, in government, in public, and to not have that be, you know, pitchforks at your door.
Yeah.
But I guess, you know, we're probably going to hear a lot worse than that in the coming years. You know, and in fact, like, we can basically trace the modern trends that we see in, like, wage stagnation and economic inequality directly back to Volcker's recession during the Reagan administration. And during Reagan's first term, commensurate with that, union membership declined by 2.8 million members, or 14%, which reduced union density from 23% in 1980 to just 18.8% by 1984. So just in his first term, it, you know, declined by that much. And that was at a moment where, yeah, like,
It was really horrifically timed too, because it was right on the cusp of basically productivity, right? As basically, you know, we're kind of on the cusp of actual personal computing and these things being something that you did at work outside of just, you know, like punch card computers and things like that. So, you know, as unions entered that era incredibly weak, right? We had all this increase in productivity and no laborers to help fight for basically that achievement.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, it you know, even though you had Reagan ran, you know, he had his two terms and then you had a Bush term, but then you immediately had eight years of a Democratic president. But because of the effects of the 80s and the, you know, specifically the Reagan administration and largely like the 1984 election where the Democrats only won one state, like Democrats as a force, as a political force, became so afraid of the Reagan revolution and of the right that they really kind of abandoned the New Deal style approach to politics and specifically to workers and labor unions that they had up until that moment. And you had, you know, Clinton come in and brought about the third way, you know, and kind of triangulating towards actually being more pro-business and trying to tack to the right and doing things like instituting NAFTA, which really was kind of the death knell. Like if what Reagan did to the air traffic controllers was really kind of the opening salvo of this is the end of unions, then the death knell of it was NAFTA being passed under a Democratic administration. So, you know, under the new Trump administration here, unlike or like in the Reagan era,
unionized employers will be emboldened to tear up the tenuous labor management accords that they have, and they'll likely be challenging unions with concessions and decertifications. Because if they are going to do the thing that we talked about, that Project 2025 wants to have done, by allowing basically employers to tear up union contracts mid-term, like throughout in the middle of that contract term, then I think we'll see decertifications a lot of major employers, you know, pretty quickly, unfortunately. And, you know, if Trump were to outlaw public sector unions, which is kind of the last bastion of unionization in this country, like there's more union density in public sectors than in any other sector of the economy. And one of the things that the Trump administration has said, or the incoming Trump administration has said they want to do, is to outlaw public sector unions. So if they do that, you know, it's a major plank of the Project 2025 plan. That would eliminate 7 million dues-paying members, on top of the sharp declines in unionization in the private sector that we can almost certainly expect to see as well. So this nightmare scenario would effectively transport the labor movement back to the Gilded Age of the 19th century, which, you know, was not a great time for workers, if you know anything about that time. There was, you know, dangerous conditions and very poor wages and all those things. So that's not a great outlook. Now, you know, it is possible that the Trump administration could moderate its attack on labor, restrained by the high polling popularity of unions and sort of his like faux populist thing that he's done, where he does kind of court unionized workers and he does say he speaks to the working class and he has union presidents come and, you know, speak at his conventions and things like that. So there is a alternative path where the sort of more populist end of what the MAGA movement represents might actually moderate his approach to this, but, you know,
it's hard. We don't know.
Yeah, we don't know. And if any past indications of what the previous Trump administration have done and the people around him have espoused, you know, their desires, it's unlikely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and obviously we don't have anything like, you know, the, you know, basically the invention of personal computing or kind of creation of the internet. But there are so many things that are very complicated and require so much tact around the forefront of labor, right? Like AI was a gigantic part of the Actors Guild and the Writers Guild strikes, right? Like earlier in Biden's presidency, earlier this year. And things like that have to be handled with so much care and understanding, right? And agencies like the FTC safeguarding the internet as like a personal right, right? All of these things are connected. And so, you know, we're going to have to see how effective a second Trump presidency is going to be. I mean, he did briefly have control of the House and the Senate before, and he was unable to repeal the ACA, right?
Absolutely.
With Obamacare. So, you know, we don't have a history of him, you know, being super effective.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, we'll have to see.
No, that's a great point. Like, you know, his previous term, there was very little actual, you know, he had a lot of rhetoric and he did some bad things around the margins, but there wasn't a lot of horrible dismantling of things that, you know, could come with the second term where the blind, you know, the guard rails.
Our institutions relatively stayed quite strong.
Yes,
so,
absolutely.
Yeah.
We'll see if they do the next 4 years. But, you know, unfortunately, we're running out of time here. But just like, you know, as national Democrats recover from their losses and as, you know, Republicans begin to formulate their agenda for the next 2 years, you know, until the midterms. And of course, you know, as the labor movement braces for an all out assault, it's clear that vote, you know, at the very least, if you look at the things that happened down ballot and if you look at the, you know, like a lot of the amendments and things like that that did pass, it's clear that voters across the country are still demanding policies to protect public services, you know, to expand labor and abortion rights and to boost wages and benefits for working class people. So if there is a point of hope that we can highlight, it is the fact that, yes, things look bleak right now, but the appetite of the American people and the American voter does seem to be leaning towards, you know, progressive policies, whether or not it is progressive individuals or, you know, candidates, but like policies did pass and they do, there is an appetite for that there.
Yeah.
So we will see. Unfortunately, we are out of time, but obviously we will continue to follow up on this in our upcoming episodes. But thank you so much for listening to Labor Radio. I have been Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gilland.
Have a good one.
David Barsamian of Alternative Radio, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad,